Good evening. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. So, I was thinking about Ibrahim Baba before this meeting, and something that was special about him I never had a conversation with him about it, but I wanted to. So, I'm not going to say I regret it, because it's also nice for it to be kind of in the mystery. But there was something very special about how he used the word or the phrase non-duality. Because the phrase non-duality in common spiritual usage has to do with perception of reality as something that's transcendent of the mind that separates things into parts, including the separation and most basically the separation between me and the rest of the world. It's not just that the stuff I see is really all one, it's that there's not really a me seeing it either. There's just this perception of reality, and that me and the me is not separate from that reality. And that's a level of perception that is often called non-duality. And he talked about that, but then he also used the word non-duality in a political way and without ever really explaining it. And I thought that was really neat. Meaning that he used the kind of spiritual perception of non-duality to give juice to his teachings about the non-separation between different traditions and different genders and different
choices.
What's that?
Choices.
Different choices that people make. Different. All the differences that we associate with human individuals and groups that he would often point out the falseness of, you know, or the incompleteness of, anyway. So, and I think that's wonderful because they're not two totally separate things, those two ideas of non-duality. One of the things that you may come to realize as you practice more and more is just the tendency of the mind to want to put things into boxes and to be uncomfortable when you can't really get what it is. Like, what is it? Is it this or that? It makes you uncomfortable if you can't tell which box to put it in, because that's what the mind is designed to do, to put things in boxes. So that's not a bad thing, but it's good to be aware of the discomfort when your mind can't really do that and allow yourself to grow. Maybe create new boxes, or maybe be comfortable stepping outside of the need to put things into boxes and to be comfortable again in the mystery. So there's this wonderful teaching in the Gemara in Masechet Brachot of the Talmud that came to me to talk a little bit about tonight. It says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, Mishum Rabbi Yose, he said it in the name of Rabbi Yose. Minayin she'akadosh Baruch Hu mitpalel. How do we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's a name of God, HaKadosh means the holy, Baruch Hu, since we're talking about Baba, Hu, Baruch Hu, blessed is who, or it is blessed, or the blessed Holy One. These are different ways you could translate it. So how do we know that the Holy One, mitpalel, prays, that God prays? Shene'emar, and then he comes with this cute little thing. He's quoting something from Isaiah, from the book of Isaiah, where the divine is talking, and the divine says, V'havyotim el har kodshi, and I will bring them to the holy mountain, V'simachtim, and I will make them sameach, I'll make them joyful, Bevet tefilati, in the house of my prayer. Tefilatam lo ne'emar. It doesn't say tefilatam. That would be the house of their prayer. right? The house of the people who are praying. God should have said, I'll bring them to the house of their prayer. But that's not what it says. It says Elah, rather it says Tefilati. In other words, God is saying the house of my prayer. Mikan, and therefore, Shehekadosh Baruch Hu mitpalel, that the Holy One prays. So, what does it mean that God prays? It's a funny concept, but it gets into the issue of what is the purpose of prayer in the first place. Someone asked me recently, because we were talking about practices and practices that I'm teaching, and they said, "Well, do the practices work? You know, do they give results?" Because that's important to know. If you're going to do a spiritual practice, you should know if it works. So, on a simple level, yes, these practices work. But on a more subtle level, what does it mean that it works exactly? It's not exactly like a mechanical thing, like you lift weights and then your muscle gets stronger. It's not like that. It's more like that there's this river that's moving. And that river is bringing us out of the consciousness of separation. It's like the river of enlightenment. Hello. Oh, hello. Come back from Costa Rica, I have to do my computer stuff, and it's been there for many days, and it had these problems, so by 6 p.m. still wasn't fixed, and he offered to come down and drop it off, so that was very nice. Yeah, that's the Mac store, so if you have Macs and you want to not go to the Big Apple store, you want to go to a local business, it's on Shattuck, you know, up towards University actually it's coming south on Shattuck. So south of University on the right. So there's this river that's moving that can take you. But unconsciously, we grab hold of the sides of the river. We're floating down, but there's a rock sticking out, so we grab hold of it. We don't want to flow down because it's an instinct. All of the instincts of what we call ego, meaning that impulse to create a sense of me, sense of separateness, tells you to resist this dissolving. And so the practices are there to help you to learn about yourself so that you can learn how to let go of the things because it's difficult to discern, to really see inside yourself when you're doing it. How do you do it? Because when you're clinging to it, you're in the reality of it. And it's tricky to be able to see that and then make the choice to let go of the handhold and to let yourself be flowing down the river. So the real prayer that's happening is God's prayer. God is doing it for you. The divine is taking you down the river. That energy is there, ready to sweep you down. All you have to do is let go. But that's not all you have to do. It's a difficult thing. That's what the practices are all about developing the awareness, and to some degree also building some kind of vehicle that you can travel in. Like, I remember doing, has anyone done tubing? You ever done tubing?
Yeah.
Tubing down the river?
Yeah.
So that's like a very kind of open vehicle, but it's good. I know it would be very rough to just flow down the river without the tube, right? And I think that if you allow life to wear away your separateness without any kind of vehicle, without any kind of way to hold that reality of what's happening inside yourself, then to continue that metaphor, just like if you didn't have a tube, you would bump into the rocks. It's the same thing. You would feel a certain amount of pain, and then you would be triggered to want to hold on even tighter. And so having the vehicles of these practices and these words and these prayers, these rituals, these times to set aside to work, to do avodah, allows you to not be smashing into those rocks so hard so you can be held and gently let go more and more and let yourself be carried down that river of enlightenment. So when you do the practice, this is also helpful to know, because if you think of doing the practice as like, I'm doing it to get somewhere, I'm doing it because it's going to work and get me enlightened or get me opened up or awaken my heart or whatever you want to think of it, if you're doing it, then in that thought itself of me doing it is a holding on to the rock. There's the technology of the prayer is not being allowed to do its job unless there's a surrendering of that sense of me that's doing it. So having this concept that's bringing out here that God prays, well, how does God pray? When you're praying, that's God praying. That's how God prays. It's breaking down this sense of me, I'm doing the prayer, and teaching this deeper insight that when you do the prayer, you can have gratitude that God is doing the prayer. You can have gratitude that this gift is coming through you and make yourself just a vehicle for that. And it can also be helpful because sometimes you're not feeling it at all. Sometimes you may meditate or do your prayer, your practice. If you're regular with it, there'll be times where it just feels mechanical or something. It doesn't feel like it's getting you somewhere. And yet, if you think of it as you are being the vehicle for it to come through you, then you don't have to worry about it. Just the commitment is enough to keep yourself committed, to show up, to do it. And that commitment is opening you to that flow that's already there, not manufacturing the flow. So there's a verse that says, Neilam vigam ein sof l'achduto. It's from the Yigdal Piyut, which is like a prayerful poem that's said in the beginning of traditional morning davening, and it's also in some communities it's said at the end of Kabbalat Shabbat. And it's a pretty long, mystical poem, very beautiful poem. And it's like the third line in it or something. It says, Neilam, which means incomprehensible, unable for your mind to grasp. Neilam, so let's just say that. Neilam. Neilam. Vagam means and also. Okay? So Neilam Vagam.
Neilam
Vagam. Ein Sof. Ein Sof means without limit. A Sof is a limit, is an ending point. So Ein Sof. Neilam vegam ein sof. Neilam vegam ein sof. So how do we know that it's ein sof? How do we know there's no limit? When we hear this idea of no limit or infinity, the tendency, I think, is to make that into a concept. You know, like it's something that goes on forever instead of something that ends at a certain point. But that's not exactly, I don't think, what it really means. It's not an intellectual concept. What it's telling you is that for something to have a limit means there has to be something else besides it. Right? You can't perceive anything unless it has a limit, unless there's something else to compare it to. If we look at the wall ends there, it ends there, it ends there. We can tell it's a wall because of everything that's defining it around it. Every color that we see is this red of this rug is very much in relation to the brown of the floor and so on. But what if there was a color that, or something like a color that everything was? You know, you could say the word, you could call it a word, but you wouldn't be able to see it. You wouldn't know what you're really talking about because there's nothing to compare it to. So when we're talking about the divine, we're talking about existence, all that is, reality. There's nothing that's not reality, right? So it has no limit to it. There's nothing to define it, which is why it's Neilam. It's completely hidden, but it's not hidden in the sense of covered up by something else. There's two ways that something could be hidden. It could be covered up or, you know, tucked away somewhere so you can't see it. Or there's nothing else except that. And so
there's no edge.
There's no edge. There's no frame. There's no boundary. Right. So how do you become aware of it then if there's no frame, there's no edge, there's no boundary? You call it something. That's why there's so much emphasis, not just in Judaism, but in so many different spiritual traditions, on divine names. Everyone gets so excited about the names, chanting the names. The dervishes chant the names. They do zikr. What does zikr mean? Anybody know what zikr means? Zik? No?
Remember?
Yeah. Yeah, zikr is the same as Hebrew zikaron, or zecher, means... like in the Kiddush, when you make Kiddush, and part of the Kiddush is Zecher Lema'asei Bereishit, a remembrance, a zikr on the works of creation. We're remembering to honor this creation that we're in by taking a Shabbat. So zikr is remembering the thing that's so easy to forget because there's nothing else except it. Right? That's also why they say La ilaha il Allah. There's nothing else. You know, the typical translation of that is the same in Islam and Judaism. You have these typical exoteric translations of things, and then you have the inner mystical dimension. So on the external level, they say there is no God but Allah. But that's not how it's intended, right? In zikr, it's intended as understanding that there is nothing except Allah. There is nothing except divine, because divine is existence. And therefore it has no limit. There's nothing to put a frame on it, so we create words, so we can focus our mind on remembering to be aware of being, being aware of existence. And if you be aware of being, then the mind becomes still by itself. You know, at any moment you can bring yourself back to just the awareness of being, and that there's nothing else except for this reality that we're in. There's nothing else except reality. That's another way of saying la ilaha illallah. There's nothing else except reality. But shamayim min ma'av al ha'aretz mitachad, and the heavens above and the earth below, ain od, there is nothing else. Hashem hu ha'elohim. Existence, it is God. Ain od, there's nothing else. So the last word in the phrase is la'achtuto. La'achtuto. That means it's oneness, it's unity. So, ne'lam, incomprehensible, inscrutable, vigam, and also ein sof, without any definition, without any limit to it, la'achtuto, is its oneness. Its oneness is incomprehensible and does not have any limit, any definition to it. So that's the chant. So let's just go over the words one more time so we can chant. Ne'lam.
Ne'lam.
Ve'gam.
Ve'gam.
Ein sof.
Ein sof.
Le'achduto.
Le'achduto.
Ne'lam. We'll see if my voice works. While you're getting it all started, anyway. Warm water, good.
Okay.
remember to let the river carry you away. The words and the melody are the raft, or the tube, the boat. Just to ease your journey, to relax into the words and let that water just sweep you down the river of non-separation. As long as those words want to keep singing in your mind, let them be focus for your awareness. And And if at any point your mind wants to let go of them and just rest in presence, and you can let go of the words, we'll sit for about 20 minutes.